We've probably all heard the stats about how little of what consumers pay makes it back to the farmer or rancher. Some producers, though, like New Zealand sheep farmer Paul Ensor, are seizing the opportunity to capture more of that value.
A lot of farmers don't know where their produce goes once it leaves the farm gate, but we're very well connected and we know what standards they require for us to grow the wool under. And so it's all about adding value, and the best way to do that is be better connected to our end customer, farm to fashion.
And Paul's capitalizing on this farm-to-fashion opportunity in a number of ways, including his own natural fiber brand called Hemperino, which is a blend of 80% fine merino wool and 20% hemp.
And there's a lot of wool blended with synthetic fibers to give it various attributes, whether to make the yarn stronger or more durable or give it some stretch. So we thought, well, why can't we do that with another natural fiber?
Hemperino's been successful, and Paul says he's having a lot of fun. But running a consumer-focused business on top of a farming operation is not an easy challenge to take on.
The supply chain's very challenging. So, like, when the wool leaves the farm, it's almost, at times, up to 18 months before we can have a garment to sell. So just all that managing that time from leaving the farm gate to hitting the store, if you like, has been quite challenging.
Paul Ensor of Hemperino talks to guest host Jeanette Barnard on today's Future of Agriculture podcast. Hello, fellow ag nerd. My name is Tim Hamrich, and every week you and I get to hear from the farmers, founders, innovators, and investors shaping the future of the ag industry. Before we dive into today's episode, I'd like to take just a moment to recognize our quarterly presenting sponsor, which this quarter is Headstorm, engineering growth for the farms of tomorrow. Headstorm's a full-service technology consultancy with been-there-done-that knowledge and expertise in the ag industry. The team at Headstorm knows which digital strategies work and which ones don't, based on the competitive landscape across broadacre, specialty, and animal ag industries. Realize your business objectives through innovative solutions and focused product strategy, swiftly bringing ideas to life from proof of concept to MVP. With elite product strategy and engineering, Headstorm provides a holistic and actionable technology roadmap that bridges the gap between strategy and implementation. From inception to execution, Headstorm helps you play to your strengths, mitigate your weaknesses, and make technology your unfair advantage. Learn more at headstorm.com. That's headstorm.com. I'll leave a link for their site in the show notes. Thank you so much to Headstorm for supporting Ag Innovation and the Future of Agriculture podcast. All right, now back to today's featured conversation with Paul Ensor of Hemperino. And hosting today's episode is my good friend, venture investor, and author of the must-read weekly newsletter Prime Future, Jeanette Barnard. Jeanette, you know I always enjoy your episodes. Thank you so much for coming back to guest host another show.
Thanks for letting me, Tim. This was a fun one.
Yeah. Well, and before we get into it, maybe let's talk about who is Paul. So how did you kind of stumble upon this story and decide that, hey, this is something that we should bring to the podcast audience?
So, you know, those random LinkedIn connections that sometimes lead somewhere interesting? That's what this was. Paul and I connected on LinkedIn, and I saw something about his company, Hemperino, where they are launching a fashion brand that is a mixture of wool and hemp. And I just thought it was so fascinating because I also knew that he was a farmer. And so it just seemed like a story that I needed to go learn more about, and saw some of the materials that they had online. And reached out to Paul and asked if he'd be willing to share the story with the Future of Ag listeners. And he immediately got excited because he said Future of Ag is one of his favorite ag podcasts. So it was a fun connection there.
Well, that is cool. Flattery will get you everywhere on this show. I hadn't really heard of this concept before. I've heard of, you know, merino wool and the high quality wool that comes out of New Zealand where he's based, but I hadn't heard of kind of this blend with hemp, which I think is super interesting. And then when you mentioned him, I looked on the website. They have really high end, beautiful products, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and hearing him talk about the R&D process and so much involved in it. And when I think of US producers and how they grow their business, I mean, the two paths that most folks go is either you go after scale, you know, economies of scale in order to drive down production costs, or you go after adding value. And in the US, from a livestock perspective, what that typically looks like is whether that's getting into some sort of a vertically aligned value chain, if you're a beef producer, or getting into some sort of direct to consumer type business, but it's really focused on the meat. This is just a different example. So I think there are definitely some specific nuggets along the way of Paul's story that can be helpful for a lot of folks, but really, I think just listening with the lens of kind of letting this expand the imagination a bit.
Yeah. No, I love it. I really enjoy stories like this that aren't your typical like shoot for the moon. It's really, it seems like building a sustainable business in more ways than one. And very, very cool. So here is Jeanette's conversation with Paul Ensor.
So I am a fourth generation farmer here in the South Island of New Zealand. I grew up on the family farm here. And then I spent 3 years at a university, an agricultural university in New Zealand. And from there, I worked for a meat exporting company in Wellington, which is the capital of New Zealand, for 2 years, just involved in the back office, I guess, in regards to management accounting. So helping produce the weekly result for the company and just being the connection between the processing and the sales, I guess, as well. So a really interesting couple of years there. And there from then onwards, I did quite a bit of traveling. So I spent 8 months up in Canada, did a bit of work up there on a hunting ranch, and then carried on to the UK, where I spent another 2 years working in management accounting as well. So in finance, really. Had a host of really interesting jobs, but did a lot of traveling around Europe and just sort of got some really good worldly experience, if you like, because New Zealand's a long way away from the rest of the world. So really good to get connected with other parts of the world and understand how they operate. So that's kind of my background. And then I came back to the farm in 2004 and took over the family farm from my parents. So it's about 1,000 hectares of what we call high country in New Zealand. So it's up in the mountains. We regularly get snow in the winter. We have some really good country which we can go good crops on for winter feeding of livestock. And on the farm, we run about 6,000 sheep and 300 cattle.
Okay. So first of all, do you consider yourself more of a finance guy or more of a farm guy?
Oh, I think definitely more of a farm guy. The finance thing was just sort of a way to get experience off farm. I always wanted to make sure that farming was right for me. So spending a bit of time away from the farm and learning other things and learning some really good business practices have been really helpful to bring back to the farm. And yeah, still rely on those today to make sure we run the farm as well as we can.
Oh, I can imagine. So before we get into, you know, kind of your latest business venture that you've started with Hemprino, tell us more about kind of the evolution of that family farm. So you said 6,000 sheep. I mean, is that the rough outlines of how the farm has looked for a long time, or has that been a shift over time?
Yeah, no, it's sort of over the years, the farm's evolved a lot. It's in the high country. So a lot of the land originally was leased land. So we leased it from the government. And then in the early 2000s, the government went through a stage of sort of freeholding a lot of the land, so allowing us to buy the land freehold. And also we had to give up some of the land, some of the higher land that wasn't really worth grazing. So we have gone from what was originally about 10,000 hectares down to about 1,000 hectares over a course of a few iterations of tenure, change in land tenure. But now we run 1,000 hectares. And since we've been home on the farm, we've developed a lot of the property. Grown a lot more alfalfa than what was used to be grown. My father grew. So we now probably run 50% more livestock than my father did, mainly in merino sheep, which we grow for the wool. So yeah, we have a lot of fine wool, which we sell into markets into the US and Europe as well.
So can you expand on that a little bit? Tell us more about what types of companies do you sell that wool to, and tell us a little bit more about that supply chain as well of, you know, once you sell the wool, where does it go?
Yeah, sure. So the wool, we harvest the wool on farm, obviously through a wool shed. We shear our sheep once a year. And then we're shareholders in a company called the New Zealand Merino Company. So it holds contracts with growers or farmers, if you like, and brands. And so the brands that we supply, for those of you in the States, will know Allbirds and Smartwool are two major brands we supply. We also supply IKEA, Icebreaker, a whole host of brands. I think there's over 100 brands the company supplies. So that really connects the growers and the brands together, which is really cool. You know, a lot of farmers don't know where their produce goes once it leaves the farm gate, but we're very well connected and we know what standards they require for us to grow the wool under, and, you know, animal welfare and social things and things like that. So it's all about adding value. How can we add value? And the best way to do that is be better connected to our end customer.
So New Zealand Merino, is that a co-op?
No, it's not really co-op because it is owned, about 50% owned by growers, and the rest is owned by private businesses or you know, other individuals. So I'm actually director on that company as well. So we turn over about probably 120 million US annually, and we control about 70% of the fine wool that leaves New Zealand. So that's anything under 25 microns. And we're also moving into Australia as well. And we bought 50,000 bales of wool out of Australia in the last year. So we are a growing business, and we need to grow as our brands grow to keep relevant to them. So we really enjoy that connection with brands and growers.
Absolutely. So before we shift then to Hemprino, tell us just, I'm assuming that a lot of listeners of the Future of Ag podcast, myself included, are not super familiar with just the structure of the wool industry. So just, you talked about fine wool, contrast that for us against the other alternatives, and just give us a little market overview, if you will.
Yeah, okay. The wool industry in New Zealand is really made up predominantly of strong wool. So that's wool that's typically 30 plus microns, and they would be off Romney sheep. Any crossbred wool sheep we'd typically be talking about. And then there's a chunk in the middle of what we call mid-micron sheep, which are Corridales, and they're probably sort of that 23 to 30 microns. And then Merinos are the finer ones. So I think the Rumbelay in the States and also the Taji are similar to a Merino. And so the value of our Merino wool in New Zealand, we're getting probably, just trying to convert it for you, roughly 10 to 12 US dollars a kilo. And at times more, that's where the current market is. And then for our crossbred stronger wool, we're probably struggling to get a dollar a kilo for it at the moment.
Oh, wow. So huge value gap there.
Yeah, huge value difference. So a lot of the strong wool industry in New Zealand are either trying to breed sheep without wool at all, or sheep that are finer in microns so they can get closer to where the value is. There's been a real collapse in the strong wool industry, mainly around synthetic carpets. All strong wool historically has gone into carpets, but there's been a big, over the last 20 years, I suppose, big upturn in synthetic fibers being used in the carpeting and flooring industry, which has really affected that industry.
And what about, I mean, is the value of that merino wool, is that holding steady, or is that price point actually ticking up? And if so, what's driving that?
Yeah, there is a real move to natural fibers in the apparel industry. I think every 25 minutes the world uses an Olympic-sized swimming pool worth of oil to make synthetic fibers for clothing. So, you know, that's a huge amount. And there is a shift at the moment, I think, towards more natural fibers, and people realizing that, you know, a lot of synthetic clothing, they're actually wearing oil against their skin, and you know, you think of that image, it's not very appetizing, if you like. So yeah, there's a real shift towards it. The market, you know, the wool industry is still really quite linked to the commodity market, so it does fluctuate a lot. I think, you know, the highest value we've got for our wool in the last couple of years is probably closer to 25 US dollars, but it's probably, yeah, it's shrunk back to about half that at the moment. It's just, there's a lot of global uncertainty out there, as you know, at the moment. So brands post-COVID probably over-ordered wool and drove the price up. And at the moment, they're just working through a bit of inventory and trying to understand, you know, what they need in the next few years is probably the challenge with the cost of living crisis that we're seeing globally.
Definitely sounds like a similar story across a lot of industries. So can you give us just a frame of reference then on how much wool is each animal going to produce on an annual basis?
Yeah, so to give you an idea, our flock, I guess we produce 3.5 kilos of clean wool. So that's after it's been washed. So our animals currently are probably giving us 30 to 50 US dollars worth of wool. Approximately a season. And then also we obviously get lamb production from them as well. So yeah, that gives you a bit of an idea. And the lamb market at the moment is quite low compared to, we've come off a couple of really high years. So New Zealand US dollars, probably it's sitting around $4 a kilo here at the moment. Sorry, I can't convert to pounds as well. That's a bit tricky. But and it's probably been as high as $6 or $7 over the last couple of years. So it's fallen away dramatically too.
And is that lamb, is the meat primarily consumed domestically in New Zealand?
No. New Zealand is probably one of the biggest exporters of lamb in the world. The majority of it is Europe and the States, yeah, into the US. So we talk about lamb being up to about 18 months of age, and after that we talk about mutton. And our big mutton market is probably into Asia and China, which there's some quite challenging market conditions there as well at the moment.
Got it. Okay, super interesting. So you've had all these diverse experiences just throughout your career. Then you came back to the farm, growing the business there. Tell us about what's the origin story around Hempreno. First of all, actually, tell us what Hempreno is, and then also just tell us the origin story of that business.
Yeah, okay, cool. So Hempreno is a business I founded with a couple of friends, or people I met actually on a leadership course back in 2018. And Hempreno, fundamentally what it does is it blends merino wool with hemp fiber to create a really unique blended yarn of hemp and merino, basically 80% merino wool, 20% hemp fiber. And the way we've created it, it took us 3 years of R&D, but fundamentally it's very unique around the world as to how we've done that, created that yarn. And then so what we make from that yarn is woolen knitwear, basically. So jerseys, sweaters, hoodies, scarves, beanies, anything you can think of that you'd normally make wool out of. But the hemp gives it quite a few unique attributes and a really cool point of difference for us. And also we're one of the few brands which is directly connected our wool from farm right through to farm to fashion is probably one way we talk about it.
Farm to fashion. I like that. So you talk about the 3 years of R&D. Did you guys start out with the vision of combining this, the merino and hemp fibers, or did you stumble upon hemp in that R&D process? What were the big rocks that you had to sort out in those 3 years of R&D?
Yeah, good question. So I guess initially when we were thinking about what we could do with merino wool, we were looking around and there's a lot of wool blended with synthetic fibers to give it various attributes, whether to make the yarn stronger or more durable or give it some stretch and things like that. So we thought, well, why can't we do that with another natural fiber? So hemp was actually the first one we looked at, and we thought, well, let's have a go, because we did some market research, couldn't find it and be done anywhere with any success. So we thought, let's dive into this because we really like the attributes of hemp and what it's about. So we thought, let's find a partner who could do that. And we looked in within New Zealand initially, and we couldn't find someone we thought would have the capability. So we actually ended up getting a grant from the New Zealand government to study offshore. And we actually traveled to China and did some investigating there with two of the world's largest wool spinners, basically, met with them, talked with them. And initially we started working with them, which one of them is actually a German-based company called Sudwoller, who have manufacturing in China. And we started working with them. This was pre-COVID, and their R&D facility is actually based in Italy. And you'll remember early in COVID times, Italy was quite badly struck. So our R&D really was stifled quite severely initially. And in the end, we actually brought it back to New Zealand, and we started working with a New Zealand partner, so which was really good to be able to bring the manufacturing back to NZ and work here. So it still took us, you know, a few iterations. So we blended different types of hemp with different types of merino wool. It took us a while to establish what worked really well. And now we've got a yarn which we believe gives us a really good finished product. It's very soft. Actually, hemp, everyone thinks, will be quite coarse because they think of it, the straw or the sort of early phase of hemp. But once it's processed, it comes out pretty much like cotton wool. And the great thing about hemp is it actually wears in, doesn't wear out. So it's very soft, durable, helps the garments keep their shape because it doesn't stretch. And it's got a really good environmental story. Those that know anything about hemp know that it grows with very little inputs, low fertilizer, next to no chemical applications. And it's a very efficient use of water as well. So it's got a really good environmental story, helps restore the soil. It's got a good root structure and things like that. So we sort of bring all that together in the combination of, you know, the wonderful attributes of wool, which are antimicrobial, antibacterial, doesn't hold odor, fire resistant, you know, whole host of things. And together we sort of reckon we're combining two of nature's great super fibers.
That's awesome. I did actually buy a shirt as part of my research for preparing for this interview with you. So I can definitely attest that it is a very soft, comfortable material. That's for sure. So
yeah, it's great.
Paul, can you tell us a little bit more about where you're sourcing the hemp and what's the sourcing story on the hemp fibers?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of challenges of finding the right type of hemp because what the challenge is you need to be able to match the hemp fiber with the wool. So not only in the fiber diameter, but also the length of the fiber. So we have scoured the world basically looking for the right type of hemp. And the big challenge is actually not the hemp itself, it's the processing of the hemp. So in New Zealand, the hemp fiber production industry is really in its infancy. Like it's been going for 3 or 4 years. There is a processing plant in New Zealand, but it can't process hemp to the right quality for us. We've had samples from the States. We've looked in France, Germany, Turkey. But in the end, all the best manufacturing we've found comes out of China. So we're able to use organic hemp from China, but as soon as we can use hemp from New Zealand, we'll be using it. The company in New Zealand is probably 95% of the way there, and then we'll be able to use their hemp. But at this stage, I mean, we'd love to use hemp from the States as well, but talking to the guys in the industry over there, they just can't quite manufacture it to the level we require because it's a really highly processed hemp we need with when I say processed, it doesn't involve chemicals. It's just about the actual mechanical processing of the fiber. So, yeah, it's a bit of a roadblock, and it has been for some time. But what we're hoping to do is actually create demand for hemp fiber and help, you know, create the front end of it so that once the production comes online, we're ready to take it and run with it.
That's really interesting because for sure in the U.S., hemp has been one of those crops that has had fits and starts as far as, you know, kind of a lot of exuberance around it that then has fizzled as the market hasn't quite been there. So this is interesting that you know, this could be a potential market use for hemp here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we've seen it in New Zealand. There's you know, it's such a wonderful plant, the hemp plant, and there's all sorts of byproducts of the fiber that you can use with regards to hempcrete or animal bedding and a whole lot of variety of things. But it'd be great to be able to, you know, use the complete fiber plant and then add as much value as we can on the way through.
Absolutely. So a couple of other questions around this then is, so one is, tell us more about your co-founders in the business and kind of what capabilities did they bring to the team that complemented yours?
Yeah, great question. So initially it was, as I said, we all met on this rural leadership course. And initially it was myself and Siobhan O'Malley. So Siobhan's actually a dairy farmer by nature. And it was actually initially her idea. And because I was the only sheep or merino farmer she knew, she gave me a call and we started looking into it. So Siobhan's really great on big picture thinking, coming up with ideas and using her really extensive network to pull funding and making contacts and just, you know, helping build a business. And then just prior to launch, actually, another friend of ours I ran into one day and I was just talking about what stage of the business that we were at, and we were getting close to being ready to launch, but we lacked a few skills between myself and Siobhan. And Harriet, she works in sales and marketing, so it was really great to bring her into the business, you know, prior to launch and just help us develop a website and make sure we had our story right and the imagery and everything else behind it, and help us build a social media following as well. So it's really been crucial that we all bring different skills, and whilst we all have, you know, a day job as such, you know, we can work in the business at different times with different skill sets. So it's been a really cool adventure, I guess. We've all learned a huge amount as we go and had a lot of fun, which has been great. You know, you don't want to, you know, if you're not having fun, there's probably not much point in doing these things because it's been challenging at times, but also, you know, it's been a good bit of fun. And we have quite strong family values between the three of us. We've all got young families. So making sure that the business works around those sort of, you know, key things, you know, key family milestones and things like that's important as well.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit more then. I mean, so it's obviously a kind of a direct-to-consumer model. How is it that you are generating demand for the product? What's kind of the go-to-market plan here?
Yeah, so we launched probably almost just under 2 years ago now, just online. Initially, we heavily relied on family, friends and relatives, and, you know, anyone that we knew to buy one, and just really spread word of mouth, which is good. And then probably almost a year ago, we actually featured on a New Zealand show, which is called Country Calendar, which is basically just a farming show, but probably the highest rating TV show in New Zealand, which is very unique. And it, you know, live to air program, not streamed. it's the highest rating show in New Zealand, so it was really cool to be aired on that. So we've been really well supported since that program in New Zealand, which has been cool. And then obviously, the power of the internet is just amazing, isn't it? Within the first couple of weeks, I think we'd shipped one to Alaska. So we were just blown away by that we could, conquer the world just via the internet. And we've sold a few into Europe and Australia. And it's just amazing where we see these orders coming from. But it's just one of those things that's just about building momentum. And we're also trying to get into a few retailers in New Zealand, but also we've just got to get our supply chain going really smoothly before this is just that old story of walking before you run. I spent a wee bit of time in the States May last year, just having a look around, checking out different markets and things. And we'd like to get into the States at some stage and probably in the next year, because we see a lot of, hemp products there and think it would be a good market for us. So we've just got to get our supply chain lined up and running really well before we commit to, bigger orders and things and make sure that we've got things lined up properly. But we've had a really, we use Shopify, which is like an online retail app, which some people will be familiar with. And we have a really high repeat customer rate, which is a really great endorsement. We sort of, it's really great feedback that we're getting customers coming back and buying again. And so that's been a great endorsement for us to keep going. And so we're just doing big pieces of work at the moment about engaging with our current customers and understanding why they buy from us and things like that, so that we can make sure our messaging is on point and ticking the boxes so we can keep growing.
Absolutely. So one of my favorite things about that story you just told is that the highest rated TV show in New Zealand is a farming show. That just seems like the most New Zealand thing. So that's fantastic.
Yeah. It's on a Sunday night at 7:30. And I think it's just become a bit of a tradition that Kiwis sit down and watch this show on a Sunday night before they start their new week, I guess. Yeah.
Before the week. That's awesome. So question for you on your customers, especially on those repeat customers, are they buying more because of the quality and the physical attributes of the product, or are they buying more because of the sustainability story around it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's something we need to understand better. I think people like the story, and I think, it's quite a lot going on there to actually decipher exactly what it is, because we've always been told not to lead with sustainability. And actually what we find with our social media posts is that people probably connect more with the farm story than anything else. So where the product's coming from. So I think that's probably been the key driver, is just that connection from, our farm through right through to the end product. I think a lot of people, it's interesting because we have been going out to fairs, trade fairs and things like that, and engaging more with customers over the last year. And it's fascinating. People come up and they almost whisper it and they say, I really love hemp. And it's funny that a lot of people love hemp, but they probably for some reason don't talk about it very loudly and things. So it's been an interesting process for us. And a lot of people have been really enjoying learning about hemp and its environmental factors and things like that. So yeah, a lot of it's the connection to farm. And the key thing for us has actually been to get out into the market and get people to get their hands on it, because the softness of it is really sells it. And people are concerned about what it might be scratchy and things like that, but it's actually the opposite. So just getting people to get their hands on it's been a really key thing for us too, to help sell. But, the fashion industry, we don't try to think of ourselves as fashion, because when you talk about fashion, it comes these days with the connotations of fast fashion and greenwashing and things like that. So we're very conscious about what we talk about and how we promote the product, which we're still working our way through. It's been a really learning process as to what resonates with customers and what are the key messages we need to be talking about.
Right. Are there any specific examples of things you've learned that don't resonate?
Yeah, talking too much about sustainability is just too much for people to take in. When you're talking about these things, customers can pick up one or two sound bites. So you've got to make sure you get the right one out there. And, we're trying to, with our product, yes, we're trying to talk about sustainability, but we're also trying to talk about the softness of hemp and the wonderful attributes of wool and then the origin story. And already it's too crowded for customers. You've got, what is it? Under a second these days to get people's attention and try and hold it. So how do you fit all that in there? You just can't. So yeah, learning as we go, certainly definitely what we're trying to do at the moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So maybe walk us through what have been some of the biggest learnings that you've had around the difference in, let's just call it the fashion business versus the business of farming and primary production?
Well, probably just the supply chain is very challenging. So like when the wool leaves the farm, it's almost at times up to 18 months before we can have a garment to sell. So just all that managing the flow of inventory, you know, we started with one jersey and one color and a unisex jersey. So that was very simple. But we've also added another three different styles and a number of accessories. And then you put that into six different colors. You all of a sudden got, I've lost track, but just off my top of my head, you know, 70 plus SKUs. So you've got all this inventory you've got to manage. You've got to think about colors that are coming, going in and out of fashion. Just that time from leaving the farm gate to, you know, hitting the store, if you like, has been quite challenging, and just making sure you get things right. I mean, the great thing about it, it's not like fresh goods like meat or something. It doesn't have a limited shelf life, but it does have a shelf life in, with regards to whether it's the right fashion or not. So we're trying to be quite timeless in our design and things like that, so it does endure. But colors do come and go in and out of fashion. And initially, we didn't have anyone helping us design, but we've now got a lady helping us design and select colors and, you know, do that planning, because that's quite challenging. And you know, what I like may not be what you like, so it's just managing all those things has been a really steep learning curve, and just making sure we don't have too much money tied up in stock. We've been very fortunate. We've carefully chosen some good manufacturing partners, and they've been invaluable giving us advice and making sure we kind of head in the right direction. Because, I mean, obviously, it's in their best interest we succeed as well. So, yeah, still early days, but learning as we go and having fun has been the key.
Sure. So how do you guys think about just the competitive landscape and what type of, you know, competitive risk there is of someone else starting to take a similar approach to the yarn combination that you've discovered?
Yeah, that's a really great question and something I thought about early on a lot. So the competitive landscape, you know, in the woolen industry, because I'm well connected to a number of other brands, it was always one of my first questions for them to find out what they thought of other players coming into the market. And they actually welcome it, because there's, in the natural fiber part of the world, you know, in the clothing industry, it's such a small component that I think the more people that are singing about wool and, you know, natural fibers, the better. From everyone's perspective, we all benefit. But then, you know, the other part of your question is really around, you know, other people coming in with the hemp merino blend as well. So it's not something you can patent, because basically it's an 80-20 blend, for instance. I guess the secret sauce is the type of wool and the type of hemp we're using and the processing that goes on prior to that. But we can't patent that, because someone could come in, you know, with a 81-19% blend, you know, so there's no real point in doing that. So that used to worry us a lot, but we've been first to market. I guess if a big player came in with it, that might cause some challenges for us. But we also have that unique story of being connected to farm and things like that. And I think that resonates with people really well. So, yeah, it's something we're aware of. We manage what we can on that one, but we also realized after a year of sweating on it, it's not something we can manage. So we just kind of move on and make sure we get the other parts of our business, you know, working as well as we can.
Yeah, control what you can control, right? So maybe one last question here. So part of what's so interesting about your story is that you guys have found a way to really go all in on the value added space, right? And obviously that looks different for a lamb farmer, a sheep farmer in New Zealand than it would for like a cattle producer in the United States, for example. But nonetheless, just what advice would you give to other farmers who are considering getting into the value added space in some way?
Yeah, it is challenging. It's not easy. But I tell you what, it's very rewarding just having that connection to customers and getting that feedback loop. So we've got a really good feedback loop as to what works well. We know what type of wool we grow works well. So then we can, you know, make genetic breeding decisions in advance. So we'll be able to make decisions on farm, which will help the end product, you know, produce better quality products. So there's good feedback there. The biggest bit of advice I'd give anyone when they're starting out doing anything like this is just talk to as many people as you can And it's a very simple piece of advice, but it's very effective. People love helping other people. So we've pretty much talked to people who we'd almost classify as competitors, and they've helped us. We've got very inquiring minds, and we're always asking anyone and everyone who will talk to us about, you know, various challenges we're having with our supply chain or anything. And even if it's not directly related, there's always bits of advice you can pick up and adapt to your situation. So we're constantly seeking out and learning and just trying to find new ways to adapt, you know, what we're doing.
Excellent. Well, Paul, this is really interesting, and that's a great note to end the discussion on, but really appreciate you making time to share the story, and best of luck to you guys.
Yeah, no trouble at all. And if anyone's interested, I guess just check us out at hemprino.co.nz, and you'll find us online there, and we ship anywhere in the world.
Well, thank you, Jeanette. Another great interview there with Paul, and thank you very much to Paul for being on the show. Before we close out here, Jeanette, I'd love to get your thoughts on something. You know, I love these stories of people trying to shift from a commodity mindset to a real brand by forming connections with consumers, with the people willing to pay up for what they're producing. But of course, we live in mostly a commoditized world. It's difficult to find stories like Paul's of people trying to do this at scale. Now, you know, obviously, it takes a lot to run a farm or a ranch, and to add on top of that, a whole nother business that is consumer facing takes an incredible amount of effort, of commitment. But I wonder, are there other systemic or structural barriers as well to farmers and ranchers not being able to capture more of the value of what they're producing? What do you think about that?
Oh, that's a really interesting one. I mean, I think there's two issues. One is that plays like this are just by definition capital intensive. And so it's either I'm putting up my own capital, or we're going to go raise venture capital, outside capital. And that is not the model for farming. So as a farmer, if you're going to do that, you most likely need business partners who have those skills and capabilities. And what I do find interesting, I mean, Paul obviously has a very diverse background. So he's pulling on some different experiences that are super helpful for him in this process. But he also has a really interesting network. You know, he talks about his other business partners who are bringing other capabilities to the table. So I think it's a combination of how do you finance these types of businesses, and how do you assemble the right teams and talent and get the right who's on board?
Yeah. Well, Jeanette, anything else we should make sure we get on tape before we stop here?
One thing that really stood out to me is, So readers of Prime Future know that I'm kind of on a kick right now of, I think, the products that are going to be the right sustainability solutions for the long run, that are going to be enduring, are products that have a sustainability benefit as a secondary benefit, that have a primary value proposition that is about quality, value, the traditional value drivers, and happens to have a sustainability benefit. And I think that what Paul said about what they've learned of not leading their marketing with a sustainability message, but focusing on the quality of the fabric and the durability of how the fabric holds up and the softness of the fabric. And oh, by the way, it also, there's a sustainability message here. Like, he's talking from a consumer marketing perspective. And when I write in Prime Future about these ideas, it's from a farmer facing perspective. And yet the principle still holds, that the best sustainability stories are the ones that are gravy on top.
Absolutely. Yeah, gravy on top. And it's great to have examples of what that looks like, where you're delivering the value with the added benefit of the sustainability story as well. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode. Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you so much to Paul Ensor for being on the show. Thank you to our quarterly presenting sponsor this quarter, which is Headstorm. Learn more about them at headstorm.com. And last but never least, thank you for your time and your attention. I do not take it lightly. I'll be back next week with another story of ag innovation.